What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
The clock is ticking as lawmakers begin taking up the debt ceiling deal. Plus, despite office vacancies, some residential areas in American cities are seeing a resurgence.
Those are areas that don't really depend on people commuting to the office. Those are areas where people live, and where actually now people are there more during the day because they work from home.
And Ukraine and its allies are planning a peace summit without Russia. It's Tuesday, May 30th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. Markets have been relatively calm lately, and it has a lot to do with a growing divide between mainstream investors and machine-based trading. Markets reporter Caitlin McCabe has more on the so-called revenge of the quant funds.
So quant funds are investment funds normally run by a hedge fund or an asset manager that trade using algorithms and computer models. So they have all these various signals that they look at to trade. When a stock or an index or something else hits a certain signal, it instructs the fund to sell or to buy. And this is different than a normal investment manager sitting at their desk who is taking more of a long-term view on the economy or markets, or is maybe reacting to a headline. This is totally an emotionless investing process.
Quant funds have been doubling down on equity markets as mainstream investors have been pulling back over concerns about the economy. Caitlin says that helps explain why investors so far haven't been rattled by the debate over the debt ceiling.
So most think that there is going to be a resolution. They're more worried about things like whether or not there's going to be a recession or whether or not the Fed will continue to hike interest rates. So they've been mostly pulling money from the market for those more global macro reasons. And then at the same time, we've had these quant funds coming in and they've been sort of steadily buying because volatility's been so low. So that's another reason why markets have been so calm. You've just sort of had these two groups fighting against each other in the markets almost.
Speaking of the debt ceiling, the House Rules Committee, which acts as a gatekeeper for legislation coming to the House floor, has begun meeting to decide whether the bill can go to a vote tomorrow and under what terms. That process could extend into the evening. We'll have updates on WSJ.com. Even if the deal is approved, economists say it will do little to change the direction of federal spending or to cool the U.S. economy. Reporter Jeffrey Sparshot explains.
Well, the good thing that it does is it avoids potential financial calamity. But overall, it doesn't have a huge impact on spending. It directly impacts non-defense discretionary spending, which is a significant part of the budget, but it's certainly not the biggest part of the budget. It will kind of cap that and then limit growth. Defense spending is allowed to increase, and mandatory spending, which is things like Social Security and Medicare, are unaffected by the deal.
Lawmakers are trying to avoid an unprecedented default. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said the government could be unable to pay all of its bills by June 5th. And the chipmaker NVIDIA briefly reached a $1 trillion market cap today, but ended the day just below the mark, closing at $401.11 per share. Shares would need to close at $404.86 or higher to fully reach a $1 trillion market cap, according to Dow Jones market data based on the latest shares outstanding. The company's shares soared last week after NVIDIA said the artificial intelligence boom is translating into record sales. Coming up, in major cities across the country, residential areas are undergoing a resurgence. That is, unless you live near office buildings. More after the break.
You're a growing business and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
During the height of the pandemic, some analysts predicted that the nation's biggest cities would experience a downturn as remote workers fled to cheaper areas with more space. It seems that didn't last too long. Despite the nation's many empty office buildings, residential areas in cities like New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles are experiencing a resurgence. Joining me now to talk more about it is Wall Street Journal commercial property reporter Conrad Poutier. Conrad, pretty dire predictions early on. Why didn't the worst pan out when it comes to cities?
I think the most important thing to understand is that cities are more than just their central business districts, right? The areas with office towers, skyscrapers, where commuters go to every day, those are actually a pretty small part of cities. When you look at New York or Chicago, they're a small fraction of the overall city. Beyond that, you have these residential and mixed-use areas, which are way bigger and which have been impacted very differently by the pandemic and by remote work, where the central business districts are really suffering from remote work, right, because people don't commute to the offices as much anymore. Some of these residential areas haven't suffered as much and some have even benefited from remote work. Those are areas that don't really depend on people commuting to the office. Those are areas where people live and where actually now people are there more during the day because they work from home, right? So say you live in Jackson Heights in Queens and you used to commute to Midtown every day. Now you don't. You work from home maybe 3 or 4 days a week or 2 days a week or whatever your situation is. And you're there. You go to the gym during the day. You maybe order lunch from a restaurant around the corner. And that actually makes some of these areas as vibrant or in some cases more vibrant than before. And it really benefits these local communities.
What's this meant for the housing market in big cities?
It's an issue for the housing market in big cities. And part of the problem is most cities in America have had housing shortages anyway, and they haven't gone away. In many cases, they've actually gotten worse. And that's still a huge issue. Remote work now means that people often need more space at home, right? Because if you spend more time working at home, if you have noisy kids or other relatives in the house, you need an extra room. You need more space. So the housing shortage has arguably gotten worse, and it's become an issue. And for cities as a whole, it's created this sort of misallocation of resources, or whatever you want to call it, because you have all this empty office space downtown that no one's using, and then you have people crammed together in small apartments and small houses and residential areas that need more housing, need more space. And the city overall has, you know, this vacant space that it can't use, and then on the other hand, this cramped space that it needs more of. And that's a challenge for cities, right? In the long run, you want to repurpose some of this office space to apartments, and maybe you even want to build more and apartments or offices or whatever in residential areas, but getting there is going to be difficult and expensive and it'll take time.
Are there other challenges cities are facing?
I think part of the challenge here is that the economies of many cities are really centered around the central business district. That's really where a lot of the economic activity happens. It's not just that that's where all the companies are that pay taxes. It's also that that's where often the most valuable real estate is that really pays for property taxes and that pays for schools and police officers and all that stuff. And if property values go down in central business districts, that's an issue for the city as a whole because it could hit the budget. And it's not clear at all to what extent maybe rising property values in residential areas could make up for the loss of value and loss of property taxes in central business districts. Another thing to keep in mind is that there's all these businesses that are kind of dependent on office commuters in downtown areas, right? There's like restaurants, there's laundry places, there's shoeshine stores, what have you. All these places have sort of developed over years and decades catering to office workers. And they're in crisis and they're struggling and they can't obviously just from one day to the next decamp to a new area and change their business model. So I think the challenge here for cities is in the long run, you can really see cities becoming better and more vibrant with more mixed-use neighborhoods, people kind of working closer to where they live. But in the short run, there's going to be some real pain because there's just this whole economy centered around the central business district that suddenly doesn't work anymore.
Wall Street Journal commercial property reporter Conrad Poutier. Conrad, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And joining me now to zero in on one of those cities, the one we happen to be in, New York City, is Wall Street Journal real estate reporter Peter Grant, who took a look at deal-making in office buildings. Peter, we know many cities are facing this problem that Conrad just spoke about, thriving residential areas, not so much in the office space. And here in New York, you found that developers are really starting to unload office space. Tell us more.
Well, office right now is getting hit by a double whammy. One is hybrid and remote work, which is greatly decreasing demand for office space. The other is high interest rates. So developers, investors who own buildings and now are looking to refinance, they have to pay a much higher rate than they were paying before. Both of these at the same time is creating a large decline in value. A lot of developers and owners of office buildings are coming to the point where they're capitulating to these new realities in the market, and they're getting out. And they're getting out for whatever price they can get. And it's very eye-opening, the kind of prices that they're accepting, because they're way, way below what they would have accepted a couple of years ago. And in some cases, they're just defaulting on their mortgages, and it's the lender that's putting the assets on the market. What we have seen is that a two-tiered system has kind of emerged in the office world. One tier are the most high-quality buildings with the best views, amazing amenities, rooftop decks, restaurants. Those are the buildings that tenants are sort of flocking to, because tenants have the problem right now of trying to attract their workers back to the office. And with these fully loaded buildings, they can do that. So that space isn't getting hurt as much. But if you have kind of run-of-the-mill, mediocre space that people really don't want to go to, tenants aren't renewing leases there, or they're renewing it for less space because they're going to remote or hybrid policies, or they're just moving out to go to the nicer buildings.
What are some of the recent sales that have stood out to you? Anything notable about certain properties that are now being unloaded?
Sure. One Liberty Plaza, a behemoth building which faces the World Trade Center. Blackstone purchased a 49% stake in that a couple years ago, and that deal valued the building at $1.5 billion. Blackstone has now just sold that stake, and that sale values the building at $1 billion. So essentially, this building has lost $500 million in value in just a couple years. That's a big one. Another one is 61 Broadway, which is owned by RXR, another big-name developer in New York. RXR just went through its whole portfolio, and the owner of RXR, Scott Reckler, called it Project Kodak, after Kodak camera. And he said, some of our buildings are film and the others are digital, and we're going to take the buildings that are film, meaning they're outmoded, they're in the past, and decide what to do with them, and that means dumping some of them. And that's what they did on this one building, 61 Broadway. They defaulted on their mortgage, and now the lender is selling that mortgage at a huge discount.
Wow. So, Peter, how does this compare to 2009, the height of the global financial crisis? Are there similarities?
There are similarities in the fact that values have gone down a lot. What seems to be a little bit different here is that the owners are capitulating much sooner. Before, in the global financial crisis, owners went through this period. Their owners and their banks went through this period, which they called extend and pretend. In other words, we're going to extend the mortgage and things are going to just work out. And you know what? That worked. That strategy actually worked. And the reason why is because the economy was able to grow out of it. This time, I think a lot of owners realize things are different, and so they're capitulating much sooner.
That's Wall Street Journal real estate reporter Peter Grant. Peter, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We report exclusively that Ukraine and its allies are planning a peace summit without Russia, according to a senior Ukrainian presidential advisor and European diplomats. They're aiming to garner support for Kyiv's 10-point peace plan for ending the war, which includes restoring Ukraine's control over its territory, returning prisoners of war, and prosecuting war crimes. The plan has strong support from European leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron. President Biden and other top leaders from NATO would be invited to the meeting, which Western diplomats hope can take place shortly before NATO's summit, which begins on July 11th. Hundreds of tech executives and artificial intelligence scientists say AI technology poses as great a threat to humanity as pandemics and nuclear war. More than 350 people signed a statement by the Center for AI Safety, which says that reducing the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority. The center did not detail specific dangers. The signatories include executives from OpenAI, which developed ChatGPT, as well as execs from Google and Microsoft, which are also integrating AI into their own products. China's foreign ministry says Tesla CEO Elon Musk told officials in Beijing that he opposes decoupling the world's two biggest economies, the U.S. and China. In a statement released today, Musk was quoted by Chinese officials as saying that the interests of the two countries are inseparable. China is one of Musk's most important retail markets and is home to its biggest manufacturing plant. Companies with footprints in China, like Apple, have reduced their reliance on Chinese supply chains. But Tesla has doubled down on China with plans for a second factory in Shanghai to build its Megapack batteries. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the trial for the man accused of killing 11 people at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018 has begun in federal court. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty for the shooter, Robert Bowers. He faces 63 counts, including obstruction of free exercise of religious beliefs resulting in death and committing a hate crime resulting in death. He has pleaded not guilty. His attorney, who is focused on helping him avoid the death penalty, has acknowledged the shooter's actions, but argues that he was acting with irrational motives. Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes has reported to prison to begin serving an 11-year sentence for defrauding investors. A spokesman for the Bureau of Prisons confirmed that Holmes arrived at a minimum security prison camp in Bryan, Texas this afternoon. In addition to her sentence, Holmes and a former top Theranos executive, Ramesh Sunibalwani, have been ordered to pay $452 million in restitution. Balwani is currently serving his nearly 13-year sentence at a federal prison in San Pedro, California. And some of the criminal charges against FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried may be dropped. That's if the Bahamas says the charges violate the terms of his extradition to the U.S., according to the Justice Department. Bankman-Fried was extradited from the island nation after his arrest in December. Since his arrival, prosecutors have added more charges, including conspiring to bribe a Chinese official. Bankman-Fried's lawyers have argued most of the new charges violate the rules of the extradition treaty between the U.S. and the Bahamas. Prosecutors responded that they do not, and that it is up to the Bahamas, not Bankman-Fried, to object. And finally, fast food restaurant Taco Bell has rung the bell on a trademark fight over the phrase Taco Tuesday. Right now, there are two companies that hold the legal rights to use Taco Tuesday, the chain Taco John's and a Jersey Shore restaurant and bar. But Taco Bell has filed petitions with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office seeking to cancel those trademarks, arguing the term is generic and that any restaurant making tacos should be able to use it. Taco Bell has even drafted basketball superstar LeBron James to appear in an ad campaign. Taco Tuesday has been trademarked since the 80s, but our reporter Joseph de Avila says there have been instances where companies lose their trademarks when use has become widespread.
Defending Taco Tuesday in court can be difficult. According to some legal experts that I talked to, the term has become so common since it's used by restaurants all over the country that makes it difficult to defend that trademark if someone takes you to court. And we've seen examples in the past of other trademark phrases that have now become generic and no longer are trademarked. And, you know, some examples are aspirin, escalator, yo-yo, and nylon.
Despite all the legal wrangling, that doesn't mean you can't enjoy a delicious taco today. It is Tuesday, after all. And that's what's news for this afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.